Okay. Good afternoon, everybody, on this beautiful February the 3rd. I'm going to go through and do introductions first with the DEAB members and then with staff accordingly. I'll go ahead and just maybe point everybody's name out as I see fit. And we can kind of go down the list from there. Just get back to Teams. So I'm Jamie Housley with the law firm of Jordan Remus, and this year's chair of DEAB, Mr. Odrin.
Mike Odrin, Olson Engineering.
Seth?
Seth Pauling with AKS Engineering.
Sherry?
Sherry Jones with SWCA.
And trying to see who else is coming in the room here. Well, we'll go through. Dan, did you just join us? Can you do a self-introduction?
Oh.
Maybe. Dan, you want to introduce yourself?
Dan Weisner, Songbird Homes.
There we go.
Okay, wonderful. Brent.
Brent Davis, Community Development, DEAB Coordinator.
Okay, Ali.
Ali Safai, Development Engineering.
I'm just going to go down the list. I see it. Brandy.
Brandy McElrath, I'm with Quail Homes.
Brian Snodgrass.
Hi, Brian Snodgrass with the City of Vancouver. Let me also introduce my colleague, Becky Catino.
Hello, everyone.
Hey, Becky. Diana.
Diana, you're on mute, maybe?
Diana Nett with Development Engineering.
Okay, returning back to a DEAB member, Eric.
Eric Lima, SJ Engineering.
See Jackie.
Jackie Camp with Clark County Community Planning.
Okay, Jenna.
Jenna Kay, also with Clark County Community Planning.
Okay, Jody.
Jody Creamer with Community Development, taking notes.
And Justin.
Justin Wood with the Building Industry Association of Clark County.
Okay. Matt?
Good afternoon. Matt Herman with Clark County Public Works, Transportation Planning.
Okay. Oliver?
If I can unmute myself, Oliver Ojaka, Community Planning, Clark County.
Okay. Rod?
Yeah, Rod Swanson, Clark County Public Works Clean Water Division.
Okay, returning one other DEAB member joined us, Andrew.
Yeah, Andrew Gunther with PLS Engineering.
Okay, anybody else that has joined us that I'm not seeing or did not call on? Okay, hearing none. First of all, the DEAB meeting is being recorded and the audio will be posted on the DEAB's website. And next we have the review and adoption of last month's minutes. Have the DEAB members had a chance to review those, and I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I have reviewed. I have just one change to take place under the second bullet item under the 2021 annual report. It was a motion to have Seth Hauling to be vice chair, not advice chair. But I'm sure he would give very good advice if asked.
Okay.
Other than that change, I would move for approval.
Okay. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. It's been moved with one minor edit and a second. All those DEAB members in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay. Motion passes. Next up, Mr. Davis, upcoming events.
Okay. Council had a work session yesterday on the surface mining overlay update. Upcoming council meetings. There's a public hearing on the buildable lands report on February 15th at 6 p.m. March 1st at 10 a.m., there's a public hearing on the 2021 annual reviews. As far as Planning Commission, they have a work session tonight on the 179th Street Access Management and Circulation Plan that you're getting an update on today. And they have a public hearing on that matter on the 17th of February. Also working on getting a notice release out for an upcoming opening on the board. Perry Wollum's term ends on March 31st, so we're getting the process rolling on that. So there should be an announcement coming out in the next few days or early next week.
That's what I'm doing. Renewing?
Yeah, I will be.
Good. Oh, and Terry, would you mind introducing yourself just so we can capture it on the notes as well?
Sorry, yeah. Terry Wollum, Wollum Associates.
Okay. With that, is there any D member announcements for this month? Okay. With that, we'll move to the next agenda item, and we'll be pretty swift with this. So I really, really appreciate Dan's hard work. He kind of did a yeoman's job of pulling together the 2021 annual report, as well as the work plan update for next year. And I did send it out to the DEEB members after last month's meeting and did get feedback from various people. And Seth, I appreciate the call and email this afternoon. There may be a little bit of wordsmithing that needs to be done. And Terry, I did get your name corrected in the revised version here. So with that, I just wanted to see if there was any additional comment or feedback in this regard, other than maybe a little bit of wordsmithing so we can get this finalized and sent to the board well ahead of our meeting in March. It's going once, going twice.
No, I think okay, it's good. Thank you both for everyone that has looked into this and provided comments on it. And I think it's going to be good to present to the county council here coming up, next month, I believe.
Yes. Okay. Hearing no other comments, again, I do really greatly appreciate Dan's hard work as chair last year, as well as him pulling together this document, and just would like to acknowledge that again. So with that being said, I think we can then move on to the next item, which is an update both from the county and city regarding the housing options. And I think we'll go ahead and let Jackie and the county do their presentation first, and then we'll move over to Brian and Becky from the city to give their presentation. So with it, Jackie, go ahead, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Jamie. Just give me one second. I'm going to share my screen. Okay, can everyone see that all right? It's hard with Teams because I can't see anybody. So speak up if anything looks funky. Well, we're here today to give you an update on the county's housing option study and action plan. And I have here with me as well Susan and Jenna and Oliver. So we're all here. If you have any questions for us about the project or the upcoming process. We last presented to DEEB at your September meeting. So we're back again today to give a kind of a progress report and let you know about the next steps so that you can stay engaged and involved in the process. So this slide shows the project's workflow since last June through this coming summer. The project advisory group's draft strategy recommendations were made available at the end of November. And since then, we've had a number of community engagement activities take place. The community engagement feedback was provided to the advisory group, and we have some information on that today, but I'll check in with you when I get there to see if that's something you want me to go into detail on or kind of just go over kind of the next steps. So we'll talk about that in a second. So the consultant team, or let me go back. So the PAG met for the last time on January 25th. And after getting the feedback they received from the public and people that provided comments, they finalized their recommendations. And now the consultants are preparing the final action plan document that will be presented to the Planning Commission and then County Council. So those meetings to review and approve the action plan are scheduled for the spring. And you'll of course, people that have signed up for receiving updates will get notified of those. But it looks like it's probably going to be April for the Planning Commission and then council following. Those haven't been scheduled specifically, so I don't want to give you dates that I don't specifically have, but that's kind of the timeline we're looking. The decision makers at that point will let us know which recommendations from those lists of strategies, which are, you know, overall ideas on ways to create more housing. So they'll give us direction on what they would like us to move forward with. And then we will begin refining those strategies that need more details, and we'll seek input from interested parties that want to participate in that process. The final steps will be the process to adopt the strategies, such as developing new or amending existing code or other strategy types through the legislative process for adoption, including public engagement opportunities. So the next kind of slides that we have, and I'll kind of pause here and ask how much detail the group wants to get in, because I don't know how many might have attended the advisory group meeting last a couple weeks ago or reviewed the recording or notes or recording. But what we have prepared are kind of the feedback that we received from the community on the draft strategies that were presented that were put out there at the end of November through January. Is that something you all are interested in hearing, or would you rather more talk about the next steps and give us any feedback that you're wanting to talk to us about?
Jackie, I think a brisk review of that would be in order.
Okay, perfect. All right. I probably have more slides than you need, so they're there for you if you want to go take a look, but I'll kind of go through just some of them if that works. One of the activities that we held was a virtual public meeting on December 14th. So we presented the overview of the project, the key findings, objectives, and draft recommendations. We used a tool called Google Jamboard, and you can see a kind of snapshot of that here. And it allowed an opportunity for people to not only verbally engage during the discussion, but for those that would rather just, you know, put something in writing and post it on the board. So it was kind of a different and kind of fun way to have people participate virtually when we, you know, couldn't have like our usual open house type of setting. If you would like to read or review any of the feedback that was collected from that exercise, we have all that on our webpage for the project. We also administered an online questionnaire between the end of November through January 10th, and we got back about 105 responses. So this was asking questions about how important certain elements, certain categories that we had organized strategies in, as well as specific strategies. So you can check out the results of those as well on our webpage. County staff also presented to various groups upon request, And so you can see the groups listed here. We encourage those that we spoke to submit comments through the questionnaire or by email so we could package those up and get those to the advisory group for their consideration and for their review before finalizing their recommendations. So I'll go through these pretty quickly. These were the output of the questionnaire. How important of housing, providing more housing choices scored fairly high, 82.6% as important or very important. 80.2% said the affordable housing strategies are important or very important, so another high scoring. 74% for programs and partnerships as very important or important. 73% said that advocacy strategies are important or very important. And then we are showing here some higher scoring strategies for categories under near-term housing options. So this is a sampling of some of them regarding near-term, revising the cottage standards and expanding middle housing types and low and medium density residential zones received the most support versus strategies to implement state-mandated multifamily parking ratios received less support. Near-term affordable housing, expanding options for affordable residential uses in commercial zones, revising the development code for the conversion of motels and hotels into affordable housing, and implementing bonus density for affordable housing on religious organizations' land received the most support. And I'll just make a note here that the specific to the implement bonus density on affordable housing on religious organizations' land. During the deliberation of the PAG on January 25th, the group decided to consider extending that bonus density to for affordable housing to non-religious organizations as well that meet the affordability and time duration requirements. So the group agreed upon that to make that revision. For near-term program and partnership, supporting neighborhood-scale retail within neighborhoods, reducing development review timelines, and identifying affordable housing point of contact received the most support of those strategies. And then on near-term advocacy, the two strategies to advocate for county eligibility for the multifamily tax exemption and for changes to the condominium defect liability law received significant support. For long-term, reviewing impact fees to reflect the impact of dwelling types, studying upzoning of existing land or applying higher density zoning to new lands, and discussing adjustments to the countywide planning policy ratio of single-family detached homes to other housing types received the most support. Studying reductions to off-street parking minimums for multifamily residential developments received the least support. Long-term affordable housing strategies receiving the most support include review and reduce impact fees for regulated affordable housing, explore tax increment financing as a tool to support affordable housing, explore development standard bonuses, and review land use and non-life safety engineering standards to reduce barriers for low-income housing projects. Long-term programs and partnerships, a universal design program for persons with disabilities or who are mobility challenged, increasing access to neighborhoods and supporting the initiative for electronic plan review received the most support, and research the impact of short-term rentals received the least. So the next few slides are the kind of the key issues that came out of that feedback. So they're listed here. So strategies to support low income and houseless, being consistent with policies and regulations with the city of Vancouver, the importance of the livability of existing neighborhoods, a concern with tax burden on residents, depending on, you know, changes made, housing choice in size, design, and price. Housing options for people with a wide range of disabilities, mechanisms to protect county investments and ensure long-term affordability. Further key issues were concern about RVs as a long-term affordable housing solution, support for middle housing homeownership opportunities, access to transit and amenities in higher density areas, and adequate infrastructure to support higher density development. And lastly, countywide housing options and opportunities, including in the rural areas, was noted, streamlining development process, reduce regulations and fees, and reducing requirements for off-street parking, and then more strategies for mobile home and manufactured home parks. So those were a summary of the key issues that were in the community engagement findings. So next steps I'll just share is, this is the project schedules that shows all the different phases of the project. We are currently in phase four, as you can see there with it outlined in red, where we are preparing the action plan. So next steps will be the legislative process. So as I mentioned before, upcoming meetings are going to be scheduled with the Planning Commission and the County Council to present the Housing Action Plan and all the background information that was created and developed to get us there throughout the last year and a half. We are encouraging interested parties to participate and provide testimony in support of the strategies you're in favor of as we go through this process. Once we get that guidance from the decision makers, we will begin working on implementing those strategies through code amendments or other processes as directed by council. So once we have their direction, we'll begin the new process for that work, which will include participation from a variety of groups, including, of course, DEEB if interested. I think that does it for my slides. Thank you for having us, and we're happy to take any comments or questions or provide any other additional information.
Okay, appreciate it, Jackie. Thank you very much for the presentation. Turn it over to DEEB members. Does anybody have any questions or comments for Jackie at this point?
I know BIA went through it. We had a committee with government affairs that went through the recommendations and definitely had some comments. So I don't know if we want to go over some of those comments. Maybe Justin may have those available. I've got a few as well. So,
and we're happy to listen, but just so that I just want to make sure I clarify that, you know, right now the advisory group had their last meeting. We're drafting the plan document. So that's done, and that'll be part of the Planning Commission upcoming work session and hearing. So any feedback, that comments you're going to want to provide to the Planning Commission as they go and review it and make their decisions. And of course, you know, I just want to be clear that a lot of this strategy, some of them got kind of specific, some of them are more broad, but no matter what, once whatever direction the council gives us, is we're going to have to refine those. So there's going to be another kind of step on working on those code amendments that we'll want your input on when we get to that phase.
Okay. So I know in specifics, like we had a recommendation that we brought to the board already about cottages and counting of garages against the square footage. And that was something that didn't make the draft at all. And I think we commented at the last work session. I think Justin and I both commented on that. And there's a few others in there as well. But
okay.
Things like lot coverage. If you're trying to do smaller lots, you have to have higher lot coverage. And I think the recommendation is like 40% maximum lot coverage. That would not work at all. There's some other pieces that are great intentions, but they just aren't functional, or they don't actually make it more affordable, and they don't hit the market demand. And that's, I think, we have to be really careful of and make sure that we're actually providing a code and some recommendations that will actually be used and will actually help solve the problem. So that's kind of what the comments are. They're very constructive comments based on kind of targeting what we see in the market. So,
okay.
So yeah, thanks. Go ahead.
Sorry, do you see that could be something that DEEB could take on a separate track when we get into the biannual code amendments? Because it sounds to me like once this process is completed, that they will look at updating the code appropriately, and then we can maybe piggyback on that with our own proposals, since it didn't make it into the recommendations, that we could then just piggyback on that and say, hey, by the way, we've got some other much lower hanging fruit that we could implement almost immediately. We just need the code to be amended accordingly in order to achieve that.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think, though, in the meantime, I think that we should maybe form a subcommittee and actually provide very detailed comments on the plan before it goes to Planning Commission and before it goes to Council. So
that's what I was thinking too, Eric. I mean, I'm understanding that the public comment period is closed. It still has two more steps in the process at this point, PC, and obviously there's going to be public testimony there, and then again with the councilors, and there'll be public testimony there. And so I think that the better prepared we are in writing, and if we want to have a representative of a subcommittee go testify orally to that with additional recommendations, I think that's wise.
Okay. And I'm fine being part of that. I can take the lead on that if you want. And what we can do is that we can put kind of a document together of what our specific recommendations are. And we just want to make sure we have time, because I think that the issue is, when's the next hearing?
It looks like we're going to have the Planning Commission process in April.
In April. Okay, so we got a little bit of time. Okay, so between now and April, we need to formulate our comments. But I guess we don't even have that draft yet. So it'd be premature to comment on a draft that hasn't even incorporated all of the comments from the last meeting. But
so I guess maybe that's a question for Jackie. When would you anticipate a draft being out?
We're working on that timeline right now. So the consultants are putting together, so they're compiling everything from, the stakeholder interview processes that we did. So we have a lot of background information to put all together in one package. I don't have an exact date for you, but I would say hopefully end of February, early March, perhaps. I got to see what kind of timelines, because we're going to have some internal reviews as well. So we'll make sure once we have it out that we share that with everyone that has signed up to receive our notifications.
Okay. So, hey, Eric.
Yes.
No, this will be kind of an ad hoc committee that you're going to run. Is there anybody else on Deed that would like to join us? And I would anticipate you maybe having a meeting ahead of this draft report kind of going out, just to reiterate some of the concerns, but then really being responsive between that March timeframe and whenever it does go to PC in April.
Yeah. Well, I can say for the expertise we have on here, Dan would be a good addition if he's interested. Justin Woods actually already been involved quite a bit. I don't know who else would be interested. Mike, I'm sure you run into stuff on cottage housing as well. So whoever wants to. I mean, we, to tell you the truth, we have a lot of stuff already drafted up that we've submitted. So what we're going to do is file that. And I think Dan has been part of – you went to a few of the work sessions too, or at least some of the
– I reviewed their notes and, yeah.
Yeah.
Eric, most of my expertise is in commercial industrial development. I think I'll sit this one out.
Okay.
Don't mind.
Sounds good.
Andrew or Terry?
I'll join in on that. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Andrew?
You guys have done the heavy lifting. I'll just ride your coattails, it sounds like.
And I will say that there wasn't much revisions from the strategy list that's posted for the November 30th kind of edition. And Brian, and we got a couple of PAG members, but there wasn't that big of changes. So, as soon as we get a final draft, I'll make sure I get it. I can let Brett know, or Jamie, I can let you know, and you can distribute.
Okay, that sounds great. So on Deed's end, I'm hearing we'll have an ad hoc committee with Eric, Dan, and Terry as the Deed members, Justin Wood from the BIA of Clark County as an ad hoc member.
Maybe Phil Mies.
And Phil as, yeah. Okay. Okay. And before we Is there any more questions for Jackie before we turn over to Brian? Okay, hearing none. Mr. Snodgrass and Becky, would you like to move over and do the City of Vancouver presentation?
Yeah, I can share the screen, Brian.
Oh, okay. Yeah, why don't you go ahead and do that? I'm trying to share it too. For some reason, it's not coming through. So thanks all for having us here today. I know many of you, but I've actually never appeared before the DEEB before. Short PowerPoint and then questions here. I know some of you have seen this before. So we have, for what we call housing code options at the city, it's sort of a shorter list of 9 code changes. And there may be other work beyond this, so I don't think this is the totality of what the city will end up doing on housing. But it's a list we've had for some time. We started this prior to the pandemic of things that are, if not low-hanging fruit, or at least what we hope are sort of doable changes in the reasonably short term. They don't include, for instance, things that I know our council has expressed some interest in getting to in the coming years of opening up single-family zones for a little more flexibility for duplexes and triplexes, that kind of thing. So we'll just talk about that, talk about what we've heard so far feedback-wise and where we're going in the process. It's essentially about midstream. We're still haven't scheduled a hearing yet. We're in planning commission workshops. Next slide. Is that me? Okay. So in terms of the process to date, as I mentioned, started before the pandemic, done some research, and many of, you know, as I think people here know, a lot of what we're talking about are things that aren't just, you know, you see in Puget Sound, but are things that are allowed in some of the local communities here. Had some developer consultation earlier in the process, neighborhood consultation as well, a digital presence throughout, but really most more intensely in the last few months. And we've had some workshops in the last couple of months as well. Next slide. So one of the standards I think was probably, you know, folks here will be interested in is creating standards for a new zoning district, not necessarily mapping it. That would be either a private applicant or potentially the city itself, maybe in the next comprehensive plan update, would need to go through the public hearing process to apply the new district on the ground. But this is just the standards. The idea is create a baseline zoning district that would allow small lots. Currently, you can only do that in the city through infill ordinance or building multifamily on single-family lots or lot size averaging, various workarounds. So wanted to create an option of a baseline zoning that gets you there. Understand that we would need to be more flexible than we are in our other single-family zones in terms of lot coverage, allowing the footprint to fill more of the lot, allowing narrower lots, more flexibility on street side setbacks. We're also, parking and access is understandably a big issue under any circumstances, but particularly with small single family lots. So we're looking at ways of incenting alley loading and shared driveways into that where we can. Also looking at ways of one of the other byproducts of small lots is that they're creating a still functioning street front environment. I know there's been some comments on this, so let's talk about that in the coming slides here. Next slide. So part of that is garage width limits, and our proposal at this stage is to limit the garage frontage to 50 feet of the garage width to 50 feet of the frontage of the house at a minimum 9. So you would certainly get that. Idea here is to facilitate on-street parking, provide space for utilities, encourage neighborhood pedestrian activity, front yard activity, and so forth. Next slide. Another is to require visible front entry. Most homes, of course, do this. Some don't. So we'd want to require that in these smaller zones. Similar ideas, create street interest, but also look at security issues through eyes on the street. Next slide. Also limiting repetition. I know many of you are familiar with this because it is required in some of the other neighboring jurisdictions. The slide on the left shows that even with houses with attractive features, if it's the exact same house, it does tend to deaden street front activity to a point. And if it's a double garage on the, as you see on the right, repetition of that has real effects on limiting not just the attractiveness of the area, but also on street parking and other functionality. So we're looking to be as simple as we can. We're trying to be simpler than the 6-pack rule that I know Richfield has, and maybe at this point our draft code is just saying that you have to be different than the houses right next to you and the one across the street. Next slide. The other one of the trickiest issues really is how and how is it appropriate, and it's not going to be appropriate in all cases, to facilitate alley loading. I know some developers of small developments we've seen in the city, Ginn in particular, has done this. Others don't like to do it. There's reasons to do it and not to do it. We're still struggling exactly where to land on this. The draft code we have basically says that you would need to do it unless it's shown to be unfeasible. We recognize there are going to be many parcels where it isn't feasible, but the benefits of it, in our view, are to create a street front environment like you see in this picture here. You don't see, of course, the alley in the back. Opportunities for on-street parking and just a more attractive and functional street front. So that's one we're still working on. We're trying to find sort of the happy medium of where do you try to facilitate alleys and where do you not. We're trying to introduce some predictability to that. It's a little tricky, as you might imagine. I'm curious to hear the discussion on that. Next slide.
Hey, Brian, before you move on from that, just back to the feasibility issue. Uh-huh. I know it's kind of a loaded word in development circles, but would that include economic feasibility of a project? I know that's sort of important for people actually trying to put this stuff on the ground.
Honestly, we don't know yet. I think the geographic case would probably be where we first want to look about, you know, is the parcel shaped in a way where it just doesn't work, or is its linkage to other road networks right next to the parcel in a way where it just doesn't work. So we don't know yet. We're trying, as I said, we're struggling to try and introduce some predictability, but also keep the flexibility that we know we need. Because you'd have to go through a rezone hearing to create the zone on the ground anyway, we're looking at are there ways through the rezone process where that would need to be identified so it would be a little bit clearer once the property gets rezoned what the expectation is.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
Okay, next slide. So some of these, certainly not all or most, but some of these standards that we're talking about for this potential new R17 zone probably, in our view, makes sense to look at some of the other existing small lots that are out there. And so some of that might be in some of the single-family development we see in multifamily zones. This obviously wouldn't be retroactively applied to existing homes, but new development in those zones, or some new developments in the R9 and R6 districts, or new development that uses our existing narrow lot standards, that those should have some of the street front and setback requirements that we're talking about. And I think that's it for the R17. So I know this group will have some questions on it. So in some ways it's just better. Why don't we head those off now and then we can finish with some of the other things. But I suspect this is number one on everyone's list.
Terry?
Yeah, I just, one of the things that was going to comment about and relates to PUDs is I know one of the things I encountered, and Eric or any other civil, feel free to correct me, but and we on one project wanted to try and provide additional parking spaces to help to alleviate parking issues within a project, and within the PUD within your open space, we weren't allowed to add parking spaces, and that would be just some language, I guess, that within the code to allow for parking spaces within the open space to help to alleviate the parking limitations that you can get with the denser multifamily zoning.
So, and maybe we can follow up afterwards, because I'm just sort of curious. So it was a City of Vancouver planned unit development where you were not allowed to provide more parking than you wanted to provide?
No, I apologize. This is within Clark County jurisdiction. I don't know if that's within City of Vancouver. It was a planned unit development, and I'm just, as it relates to if we have a planned unit development, you know, if someone's doing a PUD within this zoning type, then I just would see that as potentially, it's something that how we can help ourselves with the parking limitations, but when, as a developer, you're trying to overcome that issue or help with that issue, you're limited in the fact that you can't add additional parking within the open space. And to me, that would be something that would be important to help to provide some flexibility just to help with that issue.
Okay, Mike?
Yeah, with regards to additional parking in some of these more denser developments, I can't remember how the city of Vancouver approaches this, Brian, but I know that in the narrow lot standards for Clark County, I believe that they do have a requirement for additional off-street parking, some kind of ratio. I haven't done a lot of those developments, but they do allow, in addition to identifying on-street parking also. And so if additional parking is one of those items that is something that is needed or necessary, I would recommend that the city allow, and I don't know if their transportation standards allow this, to have off-street parking, but not in a parking lot, to be able to have it directly off the right-of-way with backing maneuvering into the right-of-way, just like a driveway. The city of Camas does allow this, and we're able to maximize the available use of the property, the entire property, by taking some of these leftover areas that might go to a lot or whatever to be turned into, you know, small little 1, 2, 3, 5 stall parking lots that come right off of the street itself, rather than taking up a bunch of land and creating a parking lot per se. That way, and if it is then part of the right-of-way, then any stormwater or anything generated from that can go right into the right-of-way, and you don't have to worry about that aspect of it. So just another tool that could be used to address off-street parking considerations.
Interesting. So, yeah, I haven't heard this issue. I can follow through with Camas. So essentially what you're, if I understand correctly, it's to create the option for a small, as part of the development, a small little a parking lot, for lack of a better word, but not interior to the development, but rather adjacent to the existing right-of-way that accesses the development. Is that right?
Right. So where you typically have a parking lot, to where you'd have to have a 22 or 20-foot wide drive aisle, you'd have to have the proper depth stalls, you'd have to have backing maneuvering and everything, and then address stormwater. In this instance, you simply have just a small parking lot right off the right-of-way, and you have just a kind of a really wide driveway drop for these additional cars, which actually seems to be working fairly well, especially when you have a fairly high dense development, and if the on-street parking is limited by either, you know, the narrow lots. You are limited then by your garage width. You have maybe some reduced front yard setbacks to accommodate what additional you might need in the back to accommodate alley loads. Then if there is any of this area that's left over, then you have that opportunity to pick up that additional part.
Okay. Let us look into it.
Yep.
Okay. Eric, I did see you come off mute and your hand's raised, so Eric.
Yeah, so some of the recommendations that I'm seeing in here don't actually address the affordability issue, and in some cases it makes it less affordable. And then some of the other ones don't necessarily hit what the market wants and may actually make it less valuable per the square footage that we're providing. And some of that is, you know, one of it's alley loading, for example. Alleys, what the market demands is they want a garage. They want to be able to park their stuff. Especially if you have a smaller home, you need additional storage. You need additional parking. It's pretty important to provide that garage space. And by limiting, like, what you can do on the front of the house, you know, you had an example of one of the homes. I think it was on maybe slide 5. So right here. Okay, the one on the bottom here. That example right there. Is if you can build those right now, they are gobbled up. This is one of the most affordable, high-demand products that I've seen built across Clark County, City of Vancouver. Now, this would basically not be able to be built with these design standards because, one, it's not alley-loaded. The garage is too wide. It probably has too much of the front, but it's a nice-looking unit. There's a lot of variation you can do in it. They've done very well, and they provide a great option for fairly affordable options for housing. And this particular one right here is about, I think, that might be a 1,700-square-foot unit. But, I mean, you look at some of the ones that you go now to the next slide. Like that. Is that much better, really, than the other one? I got to say, there'd be less demand for this home than the one just on the sheet before. And this one here provides less parking because you now have only one car that can park in front of the driveway where the other one had two. And sometimes when it's a shared driveway, you end up with three stalls there, which is actually pretty nice. And granted, you might have some on the street, but you don't have as much usually. And then alley loading, it's more impervious surface. It's more infrastructure. That adds cost. It also eliminates one of the other things that you really find that homeowners want, and that's a backyard. They want a backyard for their pets, especially millennials. I was just reading an article about the things that millennials are looking for in a home. They don't need a lot of space. They want a big garage, and they want a yard for their pets. And that product that we're pushing, instead of letting the market decide, we have design standards that we're now basically dictating what people want. And I think the market should do that. I think the city should be out of that, especially on an affordable product. I think they should. Some of the guidelines are useful, like variation in home to home. That just maintains the quality. But this is personal preference. I don't think the city should be looking at codifying personal preference and what the market demands. I think that's something that it'll work out. If they build it and they can't sell it, then they're going to stop building it and they're going to build something that they can sell. So that's just a few comments, especially when some of these items, like some of the design standards and alleys, create more environmental impact with more impervious surface, which the Department of Ecology requires limiting your amount of impervious surface. Now we're doubling up frontage where we have two roads we're building instead of one. It adds, you know, cost and higher environmental impact for less benefit, and probably a product that doesn't have as much demand for it. So just a thought.
Okay. Any other comments? Mr. Weisner.
Yeah, and I would second, you know, Eric's comments. We've built some stuff where we had tandem car garages, like what's shown right there. And people hate them because you have, you know, two cars that, you know, with a couple in there. And now what you have to do is you have to stagger who's leaving first, who's getting home last. And we got a lot of pushback from them. The other thing is that when you're talking about less than 40 feet, I know right now on your infill code, we've done stuff on the R9 and built them at, you know, a single family house at 36 wide, on 36 foot wide lots. We've got quite a few plans that can go down 24 feet wide that have two car garages, front entries, and they look just like that other picture. They look pretty nice. And we can do lots, you know, 24, 25, 27, 28. You know, I've got all kinds of plans that are 1500 feet to 2000 feet. So.
Okay. Terry, one more comment.
I just wanted to agree in all my sales experience, and specifically recent, same support as to what Eric and Dan are saying.
Good comment. Seeing none other, I guess, Brian, you can continue along.
Okay. We got just a fair amount to, and I've got a couple more and then turn it over to Becky. But new multifamily district, I don't know if that's as much interest to this group, but the same idea of proposing standards for a district that would need to be rezoned to be applied, allow 50 units an acre. You can currently do that in the city only as part of a mixed-use project or downtown. We'd also have to increase the flexibility on lot coverage and building heights, probably take the building heights to 60, maybe 65. Also wanting for several reasons, wanting to lower the minimum parking requirement from 1.5 to 1. As this group well knows, there's a disparity in city standards between what's required for multifamily, which is 1.5 units an acre, and single, only one unit per space per unit. even though, you know, any traffic study will show that an ITE and so forth, that multifamily on a per unit basis generates less traffic and significantly less traffic than single on a average per unit basis. We have gotten some pushback on that, so it'll be interesting to see how that works through the process. Part of our thinking here also is to be in line with what seems to be, and we'll see what ends up getting adopted, a real trend in state legislation, starting for on corridors, but some of the more recent stuff that the governor came out with recently is looking much broader than that. So clearly a trend to and one of the mandates we'll get to in a second is near transit of requiring governments, cities at least, to do lower levels of parking for multifamily. So interesting to see how that plays in the process.
Hey, Brian, I got a question on.
Sure.
Yeah, I got a question on this one. Just obviously, this would be a new zone. This would be a very intense zone, and sort of similar to the last one in the single family context.
Yeah.
If this is going to be applied for through a rezone, I guess prior to the city designating these spaces as maybe part of the comp plan update, how is one going to get around the spot zoning issue? Is it just going to be based on, like, this is a new zone and we sort of the appropriateness of it based on other criteria, or
to be in the same comp plan as the urban high density? So it wouldn't necessarily be spot zoning. It would just be included within that urban high density comprehensive designation.
You know, spot zoning is sort of the legal aspect to it, and there's a practical one. As a legal matter, we've had actually some discussions at council in front of this, and my general understanding is it doesn't mean you can't take an individual parcel and zone it differently. It just means you can't do that for an arbitrary reason that's not backed up as a goal of your comprehensive plan that doesn't fulfill something. That said, I know we had a recent rezone at council where staff was supporting an applicant proposal to go up to R30 from R18, and the council ended up bringing that down to R22 in part because it was a single parcel. So I'm not sure. We haven't looked at sites yet. We're just not there yet in terms of thinking about where this might go, but I think we probably want to, to the extent the city does zone it somewhere, we would probably want to put it somewhere where there's logical reasons for it, you know, near transit or some other reasons. But I would think and hope some of this and some of the R17 that I just talked about gets zoned through the private application annual process as well.
Yeah, I just a comment, you know, obviously representing applicants that do this stuff. If you get opposition to it, the first place that they're going to run to is a spot zone argument, would be my guess. And so I think trying to just be mindful of that in terms of drafting the locational criteria and maybe having some flexibility or legal means to tether yourself to in terms of where this gets applied or not, might just sort of a thought.
And Brian, would both of these be included within the urban high density comprehensive plan designation, so that if you have a parcel that's within the same designation, it would just be a straight zone change, and so you have to go through the annual review?
The R17 would be part of the single family constellation of zones. So,
okay.
And the R50 would be part of the multifamily. So yes, that's okay. The idea that if you wanted to make those switches within other less dense districts, zoning districts, you'd just be looking at a zone change.
Okay, very good. Thanks.
There's positives and negatives with that, though. I mean, the positives are is you're not having to wait a full year to make application for that. The negative is it does give more rise to that spot zoning issue than doing a comp plan amendment, which is more of a legislative call. So I just caution the city to make sure you're tethering that so it can become a reality versus just something that's on the books.
Okay, well, with that, there's still a few to cover here, so let me jump ahead here. Cottage Cluster, I know that this group's familiar with it, with discussion even today about it. We're looking to borrow from a lot of the local jurisdictions around here. We have good practices on this. So the idea is to we're proposing to use the density bonus that's used in the county in Ridgefield and Battleground. That's pretty big by state standards, a doubling. So as part of that, we as part of how we're approaching the broader community in terms of this is saying, yes, you do get to double the density, but you have to have smaller homes. And so the proposal here is limit those to 1,600 square feet per single, 3,000 for a duplex, and heights less than the single family zone would normally allow, 35. So at the perimeter, 25 feet height, in the middle, 30 feet. Let's go to the next slide and we'll talk about some of the other provisions. Here's an example a couple of years ago from Battleground of a house that got built under the cluster. At this point, we're proposing that at least 75% of those units be oriented to the common courtyard. That courtyard be sized at 200 square feet per unit, one parking space per cottage required. If there's on-street parking, you can get credit for that. If it's subject to normal subdivision rules, so if it's land to be divided, as we understand is typically the preference rather than a site plan rental arrangement, it would require a public hearing if it meets the 10 lot subdivision standard. Next slide. Here's an example from a couple of years ago at Battleground, cottages at Robeson Place. That was the house I just showed you was part of that. Next slide. And so let me take any questions on cottage cluster.
Anybody on cottages?
I would kind of echo some of the same comments that we had with the county cottage code. And then the other thing that we see is if you're trying to get a density bonus, like trying to actually get additional density, and the only way we found that it's cost effective, it ends up being pretty skinny homes, fairly close together, which is a little different than a typical cottage development. But that's how it's been cost effective. Otherwise, the density you get is really no higher than what you get for single family, kind of fee simple type homes. And it ends up when you go through the pro forma and you look at the options, it's not feasible and it's not the best and highest use. So again, like looking at what actually will work and be able to be applied, not just, some of the comments would make it less desirable or not cost effective.
I've talked with county staff on and off, but not recently in the last month about cottage development in the county. Have there not, though, been recent developments in the county for cottage clusters that develop more densely than the underlying single family zone would allow?
Yeah, they are. The ones that are have been cost effective that they're doing, it ends up being a skinny. What you see happening is they're basically detached townhomes. And they have an open space behind them usually. They're still fronted towards the street because that's kind of what the market wants. They want them kind of fronted towards the street. If you actually front them the other way, then you're looking at the back of the house when you're driving into your alley. And it's not necessarily, I don't think, what kind of the market's demanding. Instead, it's like a common open space like you'd see maybe in like Sun River, but on a smaller scale where you have kind of like maybe a trail in the back, kind of a park in the back. Some shared open space in the back,
right. But
you're not seeing the typical, I mean, we looked at some examples where you had these cottages clustered around. The problem is the density is not there to make them cost effective. They're too small. And they end up not being the best and highest use. So people don't build them and we don't get that affordable inventory. So trying to make sure we do something that actually does pencil out and will be used, I think is important. Otherwise, we're kind of wasting our time. Having garages as well, not counted against it, that's against the allowable square footage. That's pretty important.
We were aware of the discussion that's been going on. We had our consultant look at that. What we're recommending is a compromise that you could, up to 200 square feet, you don't have to count of the garage. And yes, I know garages may be bigger than that, but
probably not an effective size. I don't think 200 square feet. You probably need to go 300 to 500 is what you typically see. And that's one thing else that's kind of interesting. When you look at what a family needs, the footprint of the home is set by the bedrooms and the bathrooms. So what you see a family wanting is 3 bedrooms. They can be pretty small bedrooms. And then 2.5 baths. You have 2 upstairs and 1 downstairs. That's kind of that like magic number that families and even roommate situations want. So the footprint of the home is usually controlled by the upstairs. So it's the space that's needed to put two small bedrooms, 1 large bedroom, and a bathroom. And that controls the square footage. Then below, you fill it in with miscellaneous other things. So you end up with a kitchen, you know, usually like a great room and a bathroom. And then you have kind of extra space. That extra space ends up being the garage.
I think we lost Eric.
Yeah, I think we lost Eric for a second.
He's frozen.
He's frozen. Okay, we'll wait for Eric to come back. In the meantime, Dan, you got your hand raised.
I just had a question with Brian. The question was about the pedestrian access. Is that going to be a requirement or just it's okay to have pedestrian access?
No, I think, you know, we're not necessarily in final language, but I think some sort of requirement to link the cottages to the open space. So some of that's that a certain percentage need to be oriented to it, and some of that's that you have a path, a pedestrian path. So it's probably a requirement.
Okay. And then I would reinforce what Eric's talking about. You know, I've built townhouses for the last 25 years.
Yeah.
And I've been able to get a 2-car garage in 340 square feet. You know, it's tight. You know, a lot of stuff that we actually do a 1.5-car garage just because somebody puts a car in there and then they have the extra storage. So just being able to have a little bit more space for storage is a big deal.
Part of the dilemma we're facing is, I guess, just some with sort of a specialty product like the cottages is just, I guess, a recognition that for some housing consumers, it's not going to – so for some segment of the market, just to talk about it in those terms, for some segment of the market, it's not going to work. For some segment of developers, it's not going to work. Where the line is and where we should consider it, you know, we don't really know, but I think we're at least at staff of – tried to acknowledge that it's sort of an unusual product. It's not going to work for everybody, and we obviously want it to be out there as part of the arsenal of affordable housing, and also cottages provide some level of community interest for some folks who are, you know, maybe retired or whatever, who want that kind of a community feel.
I believe that your R17 zoning will make a big impact on affordability sector, and it will decrease the desire for the cottages. So, and I've looked, I mean, we've actually gone through full layouts and stuff on 3 different cottage products in the county and abandoned them, every single one of them, because at the end of the day, it's exactly what Eric said. At the end of the day, we come through there and our pro forma is it's just slightly less than the, you know, building a bigger house.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a fascinating conversation. I guess I just have one question for you guys. To the extent you know, of the cottage clusters that are being built in the county or anywhere else for that matter, the small cities or other jurisdictions further away, to what extent are those conventional housing developers building, or to what extent are those sort of niche developers who have found this is kind of their sweet spot for whatever reasons, they like it or whatever? Tell me what you know about that. I'm just curious.
Terry could probably answer that better because he sees the market a little bit more fully than the rest of us.
Yeah, and Terry, you had your hand up next. So, and Eric, thank you for coming back. But let me pivot to Terry first, and then we'll go back to you.
Yeah, I mean, someone can correct me on the cottage, how many people have done cottage developments within the Clark County jurisdiction, but maybe 2 projects that I've heard of that have taken place. And so in general, and I would say the development community is shrunk to about 20%, as far as those that are participating in development is shrunk to about at least 25% of what it was maybe 5 years ago. complexities, difficulty of financing, things of that nature have made it more complex as it relates to doing projects, and it just limits those that are participating. And so I agree with everything that's being said. To me, I was going to say on the garage side, 360 square feet is what you need, and there is just this threshold as it relates to, I think there is a single level home that it's the other aspect we haven't talked about is appraisals. And when you get to a home type, it has to be something that can be financed. And with the price that you have to charge for a home, and this is not for crazy returns or anything of that nature. It's smaller returns because it's typically a percentage of the total cost of the build. So you're talking about the lowest end of what the profit would be to a builder or developer or even a nonprofit, and who's not taking a profit on the house. And it's extremely difficult to make those margins work if you can't get that square footage up, because we're all aware of the same conversation of those cost centers in the home are, whether it be the permit or your heating or your kitchen and your bathrooms, like those are your main cost centers. And the more square footage you have, the more you can spread that cost. And appraisers typically really look at the square footage to help to set the appraised value. So finance is a big aspect of it. I would say, how that affects price. We've seen it work to some extent, but it's a high risk as it relates to single level product because your price per square foot is something it gets dramatically higher when you do single levels. But there is a demand for it and there's some support for it. And sometimes, a lot of times, we just see those sell for cash, and there's not exactly, and that's unfortunate, right? Because that's so limiting to the people that can actually use cash to purchase a home for themselves. And so it would be all of us, have a desire to be able to help to stem the tide as it relates to appreciation and values and making it more available for our kids or grandkids or those that are, downsizing, to be able to have a housing product that they can get into. And Cottage would really provide for that. But I would just strongly reiterate that garage is something that people are wanting. Maybe at some point in time when we get to the future and we have automated vehicles, then we're only going to have one car. But that's not where we're at yet. And so that larger garage size, and I would say 360 square feet, that allows for 18 by 20, that provides for what a buyer's going to want, what someone's comfortable in building. Maybe in a very specific area in downtown Vancouver, and I would only say in downtown Vancouver, because of walkability, you could see the cottage zone working. But that's where you're seeing more so multifamily high rises, right? You're not seeing a cottage zone taking place in that area. So to me, this is more so something to be used in the peripheral areas. And so, yeah, it's saying more of the same, but I definitely agree with the sentiments and the concerns. And it's something that we would love to have because it really would help to fill that need.
Great, thanks. Yeah, no, fascinating discussion. I wish we had more time. Let me jump to the next one because we got a couple more to go.
Wait, Brian, real just quick, Eric, did you want to finish that thought? And then I'll squeeze some more time from Matt.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Eric.
There you go, sorry. Sorry, the app crashed right as I was finishing up my thought there. But so you were asking how many cottages. We had probably about 5 cottage projects going, and then they almost all got put on hold when the garage thing came up. They were no longer financially viable, and there wasn't demand for it. And it was no longer the best and highest use. So the ones that did move forward with the condition saying that when the code gets fixed, and they allow garages, to be excluded from the square footage requirements, then it would be, then they could go to those standards once the code's changed. So that's why it is such a critical issue. And that's why it's so important. If we put this code in there that has these restrictions with good intentions, it makes these projects non-viable. So that's it.
Okay. Appreciate it. Brian, go ahead.
Okay, quickly. So one of the things that the FirstQuest neighborhood actually brought this to our attention, that the standards for a new apartment going in next to an existing house are pretty, perhaps overly permissive in terms of buffering and setbacks. The city code, as you probably know, it's all dictated by what the zone is, rather than what the use is. And that's appropriate, but nonetheless, to allow an apartment, particularly some of the taller ones, to go in 5 feet away from the property line for, next to an existing home is something we've heard about. And so we're proposing to do a couple of things. One is to increase that setback to 10 feet. We're wary, obviously, of the land supply implications and all of that. But and also perhaps for when the apartments are taller, that's particularly if they're taller than what a single family home could be, the 35 feet limit, that some additional either setback or higher wall, that kind of thing, is probably appropriate. Maybe if it's a bigger multifamily project where there's a little more flexibility about where you can put the apartments, that maybe something like that would make sense too. So we haven't gotten to final code, but we're definitely looking at increasing from the 5 foot setback for multifamily directly abutting single family. Any questions on that?
Yeah, I
got Mike.
Just one comment. I think that it needs to be taken into consideration where the single family residences are actually located. If these are larger lot single family residences that are have large backyards, that impact isn't as great as if it were something that's like a higher density to where they have smaller backyards. So when you talk about going above, because I know that some are going now to four-story walk-ups, which are actually starting to come out now and completely understand the, if I had something like that going up in my, behind my house, I would certainly be concerned about the impact of that. But just some flexibility. These codes are, hey, this is the zone next door. There's no consideration to the uses on the zones or on the properties with regards to buffering, screening, things of that nature. So just take that into consideration that if it's single family residential, if it's already built out and if they're large lots, then maybe that if you start stacking and then moving, I know that part of the city's code is that over a certain height, you have to have an additional foot, additional setback that the current or existing development on that property should, the adjoining property should also be considered.
Yeah. One of the challenges we're facing on this, and it's, you know, it's really more of a problem for us at the city, but, you know, with any government that's administering a code that has, you know, thousands of potential users or affected parties, is trying to balance the sort of situational specific things, like, in other words, what you're talking about, which makes sense, of recognizing the uses involved rather than just the zones, with basically administrative simplicity of having something that can be, you know, administered on a you know, reasonable basis. So that's sort of a, just so you're aware, kind of a tension that we're working through now, is how do you do this in a way that can be done quickly for many, many lots, many, many checks, you know, that kind of thing. So, okay, with that, let's go to the next slide, and I'll turn it over to Becky for the rest of the presentation.
All right. So the next code update I'm going to talk about is apartments with shared kitchens and bathrooms. So these would be allowed anywhere apartments would be allowed, so in multifamily zones. And these would share kitchen bathrooms, like I said. And our code does currently allow this, however, with a medical component, so having a staff member on site 24/7. So this would remove that. And then this type of housing we anticipate would be possibly for dorm style, kind of higher end in larger cities with tech companies. We've seen this, and it could also go on the other end, affordable, like the SROs of the past. So that's kind of the thinking. And to date, I don't think we've had any inquiries on this. Any questions on this before I go on?
No, I just, I've been made aware of a really cool project that the architect firm Owen Gabbert LLC is doing in Portland called The Outpost. You guys may check that out, but it's a sort of a similar concept where they have shared common spaces and doing something really, really intense on a really tight lot. So City of Portland's already moving this way.
You said that was called Outpost?
The Outpost by Owen Gabbert LLC.
Thanks.
And Jamie, if I might add, they do a lot of projects like this up in the Seattle market as well, King County, Snohomish County. The feedback that I've heard is the caution around the shared bathroom facilities. The shared common area is actually, those tend to be the apartments that people are more interested in, where they have a private bedroom and bathroom. And then the kitchen and common area is the shared space, along with like shared balconies for outdoor space would be another thing that to consider. People love to have that.
Thank you.
Okay.
So next up we have ADUs or accessory dwelling units. So this is a change to the existing code that would allow ADUs that have been in the neighborhood, they're historic, that even if they may not meet the setback requirement, as long as they can meet the other ADU standards or the building code standards, we would allow them to apply for the ADU for the building. And the top image you see is the two-story that staff were now considering that if there would be a second story, there would be a need for an additional 3 to 5 foot setback based on the input we've received so far.
Is that based on building code?
The setback or?
Yeah.
Yeah. The input we got was based. We started out saying, you know, if the garage has been there and the neighbor, you know, everyone's theoretically used to it, why not let it get replaced if it can meet the codes? And what we got a little pushback, which I think makes some sense. That yes, the short garage has been there forever, but a 20-foot ADU is not. So the idea is that if you want a full second story, you know, you get through the ADU standards. You can do it, but that second story needs to observe the setback. It doesn't get allowed just on the basis that the shorter garage had been there already.
Oh, okay. So so in part it is, and I'm sure that there's some building code requirements as far as the setback's concerned. Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Okay, go ahead, Becky.
So next we have new construction to allow aging in place, looking at providing an incentive for this. So those would be features such as zero step entry, wider doors, and bathrooms on the first floor. And we know Ridgefield is currently doing this with a 10% permit fee reduction, but they haven't received applications. So we're thinking of doing something different with an expedited building permit review. Any questions?
Nope, not seeing any hands raised either.
Sorry, I can't see anyone. So this next one, the county talked about the density bonus, the state requirement for faith-based residential buildings. And we also, like the county, are considering allowing this bonus to be not just faith-based developers, but any entity, nonprofit, affordable housing developer. Questions? No? And then the parking reduction, Brian mentioned near transit, another state mandate. So for market rate, the parking minimum would be reduced to 3/4 of a space per unit or 1 space per bedroom parking space for developments that are within 1/4 a mile of a transit stop with a 15-minute interval. So that's pretty, limited within the city. And then affordable housing would be the same parking minimums. However, that gets lowered to stops with 30-minute interval or raised. I don't know. But so that would be a larger area of the city. And then senior or disabled housing would no parking minimum, but the state law would allow for parking for guests and staff. So we would enact that. So we're also considering expanding for senior and affordable those parking minimums citywide. And the reason behind that is there's, you know, research out there that those types of housing don't generate as many trips as a market rate. And, you know, the state mandate is coming out for a reason. So there's just trends that way. But market rate, we would adopt as is, just the minimum state requirement.
Okay.
So then to go over recent feedback, I think some of you all were at our January 6th developer roundtable. Kind of, you know, a lot of these have been echoed here today. Larger ADU allowances on properties with a smaller main dwelling, larger homes in the cottage clusters, the garage, a larger footprint for that. The garage width on the R17. And then we also had a meeting with the Vancouver Neighborhood Alliance that they had a lot of concerns around parking with the smaller lots and just in general, there's not enough parking. And the setbacks as well, permit impacts to park fees. There was also the comment raised that aging in place incentives could also be extended to remodels, which we thought is a interesting and valid point, but that's kind of a little more administratively difficult to figure out at this point, but in the future maybe. And you know, questions around the rezone for the new R17 and R50 like you raised. And then we also had a wider general public open house. So again, parking concerns, the issue of short-term rentals came up in the ADUs and cottages, along with parking, kind of fire access and garbage pickup, just making sure new developments like in the R17 would have access to that, and the second story garage for ADUs. So our next steps were continuing to refine this code language from stakeholders such as yourselves. And we're going to have another neighborhood association meeting and any group that would request we speak at. And then there is a planning commission workshop on February 22nd. So this is not a opportunity for public comment, but a hearing would be. So we'll make sure to share those dates once the hearings get scheduled. There's our information and the website for our page. There's a survey. If anyone would like to give more in-depth feedback, you can use the survey on that page.
Okay, wonderful. Well, do one quick round robin here. Any D members have any final thoughts or questions of Becky or Brian while they're here? Going once, going twice. We really appreciate Becky and Brian, you guys coming into the firing squad here today and to give an update on what the city's doing. And I think it's important also to see where the city's headed, because it does implicate what could and also should be being done in the county, especially if those areas do eventually become part of the city. So we really appreciate you guys coming here today. And with that, I will go to the last item on the agenda today with Mr. Herman and giving us an update on the 179th area.
Thank you all. And I will try to go through my presentation rather swiftly. I'm sure there'll be questions, but I want to respect your time as well. So I do apologize in advance if I'm going over stuff quickly and I don't go into details, but I'll try to clarify those in the comments. So first off, 179th Street Access Management and Circulation Plan is what I'm here today to present to you. 179th Street is unlike other streets in unincorporated Clark County in that it's planned for a series of roundabouts throughout the corridor. With those roundabouts being proposed and being planned and developed and designed, that brings a whole new animal for how the local roads access 179th Street. So we went forward. We started this planning project back in the summer. We've had two different committees voice their comments and get their thoughts on with a proposal moving forward. So this access management plan, as I'll move forward in my slides, is open for comments and questions and concerns. So I will try to address these agenda topics quite briefly with time. But what we really want to do is we really want to take a pretty detailed look at 179th Street and recognize that we need from the public side to promote that safety and mobility of this future principal arterial 179th Street. But in doing so, we have to balance the needs of infrastructure and utilities for the development that's going to happen in this area. 179th Street, as you all know, has some significant concerns when it comes to hills and valleys. Those hills and valleys have some significant site distance issues, and it really is a concern for how local streets and collectors can get access off of 179th Street. In order to improve this currently two-lane rural road to a four-lane section with a center turn lane in some sections, there's several cuts of those hills that need to happen and fills of those valleys. And I'll go through this topology type in the future slides here. But we really have to address these access locations to promote the safety and mobility throughout that corridor. So we have a couple different goals and policies that help us guide the development of that plan. Goal in our comprehensive plan is to optimize and preserve the investment in the transportation system. Basically, don't build what's not needed. If we want to make sure our investments are wise and we optimize that system. We also want to ensure that that mobility is available for all users. In this corridor specifically, there's everything from commercial, industrial, residential, office, mixed use, all different types of zoning districts. So each one of those zoning districts has different users that are associated with it, and we all need to plan that corridor so that it can move that infrastructure and move those folks. The planning study is in the northern portion of the Vancouver urban growth area. It extends from Northwest 11th Avenue on the west side of the interchange to Northeast 50th Avenue on the east side of the interchange. This is a large corridor now, but what you're looking at now is the arterial atlas. The arterial atlas is our long-range transportation circulation plan. This is what is in the books now. This is what has been adopted now. And it's color-coded based on classification. And the future roads, the planned future roads, are shown in that hatched pink area, meaning that that is a line on the map. But if you go out there and look, you're not going to see a road. It will come.
Matt, real quick, quick question. This has always been an issue with us looking at the arterial atlas where there wasn't any consideration given to, say, critical areas, wetlands, topography, things of that nature, and just looking at basically, hey, this is a good place for a road, it meets our spacing standards and such. Was there a little more analysis given to this particular, I know it's adopted, but was there a little more analysis afforded to these proposed arterials as opposed to what may have been done in the past?
So, Mike, you're doing a great job of giving me a segue to my next slides because
I'll
specifically address the environmental constraints and the typology as we move forward.
Very good. Thanks.
Hey, Matt, one other thing that's related is bisecting. So making sure the roads don't bisect parcels that are zoned multifamily or like commercial industrial. Normally you don't want to, it breaks up the site sometimes to where they're not very usable. Typically, no, a subdivision is different when it's a lower density residential because you're accessing off the streets. But when you go through a multifamily, a lot of times they're gated communities and they're not really set up to have a, you know, a road go right through the middle of it. It segments it too much. So you want to try to avoid that where possible as well.
Same absolutely. You're absolutely right. And I totally agree that as much as possible, we try to put those future roads on property lines so that it doesn't bisect the property and it can be planned accordingly. So we used several different mapping websites for this. We had a specific project interactive web page. If you have a copy of this PowerPoint presentation, these are hyperlinked, so you can click on these and go in and play with it, do more analysis than I can do. So a little bit of history on the 179th corridor. It was added to the Vancouver urban growth area, approximately 2,200 acres back in 2007. 2009, there was a sub-area plan called the Mill Creek Sub-Area Plan, which is on the south side of 179th and west of 50th Avenue. That was a zoning code amendment, arterial atlas amendment, as well as a comprehensive plan amendment that developed that sub-area plan. In 2015, this is really when the ball got rolling. The Washington State Legislature funded the reconstruction of the I-5 179th Street interchange. In 2020, we went through the process. You were involved in this. We received your recommendation, and urban holding was removed by Clark County councilors, and it allowed this urban level development to occur. I don't think I need to go into details on the urban holding. As you know, that this was a restrictor plate put on urban level development that has been removed. Urban level development can now commence in this area. Also in 2020, there was the pedestrian access code adoption. This was a code adoption that required pedestrian access ways on major roads. Again, this went in front of DEEB recommended approval for this code adoption as well. So along the corridor, there are several different types of intersection controls that are currently on there, all the way from two-way stop controlled to signalized intersections and all-way stop controlled. And it runs the gamut throughout the corridor. Here you're seeing a map of the area 179th corridor from northeast 29th to northeast 50th. So we're going to be going from the east to the west. The green squares and the red triangles are showing where there's current driveway access locations on 179th Street. And then you're also seeing the zoning districts highlighted based on the zoning code, zoning classification. The difference between the triangles and the squares, and you'll see this in greater detail in future slides, but they're based on where the driveway access is compared to what the ultimate typology of the future road will be. So we wanted to identify those driveways that will be above or below the existing grade and will need to be mitigated in order to raise that driveway up to the future standards, future location.
So I'm going to assume, Matt, that the green means good, red means bad.
Okay. Bad. I don't want to say bad as it's fixable. we'll mitigate it. Okay. So I don't want this. I know this is being recorded. I don't want this to come across as though we don't have a solution for it. This is. These are identified as areas that we need to address. Here's that same map from 29th Avenue to the interchange. Again, the driveway location shown here, as well as the zoning districts.
And then it's fairly level from the interchange to Northwest 11th Avenue, at least a lot more level than east of the interchange. But again, you're seeing a significant amount of driveways that are on 179th Street. So here's, Mike, the map regarding the typology. And what you're looking at, I'll try to explain this. If you need clarification, let me know. But the future grade of 179th, in order to bring it to its classification, is shown in red. The green dotted is shown as the existing grade, the existing typology. So you can see in areas where, like where it says existing profile, there's a hill there that needs to be cut. And then just to the east of that, you're seeing a fill or a valley that needs to be filled in order to bring this up to its full potential. Each horizontal line is 5 feet. So you're seeing a significant amount of grading, filling, and cuts necessary to bring this to its classification and its design speed of a principal arterial. So this is 15th Avenue to 22nd Avenue. So this is east of the interchange. Here you're seeing the most significant change. Here from 25th Avenue to 37th Avenue, you know where the 29th Avenue intersection is. If you've driven this road, you know that it's right on top of a significant hill. And here you're seeing the change from the existing in green to what's needed in red. So a significant amount of valleys, significant amount of cuts from the existing profile, and most significantly, right here near the 34th Avenue, you're seeing a fill that's generally necessary about 30 feet there. So that's really significant as far as bringing this up to its classification standard. Again, this is the map continuing from the east, from the west to the east. Here you're looking from the BPA power line to 50th Avenue. And you're seeing the valleys that need to be filled and the hills that need to be cut. Environmental constraints. So this is what we're... Again, this is, we're going to go from the east to the west here. So this is 29th Avenue to 50th Avenue. Here you can see the Woodbrook PUD overlaid on the map that shows the environmental constraints, both shown as wetlands in the teal, as well as streams that cross 179th Street. Environmental constraints from 29th Avenue to 50th Avenue are shown here. And environmental constraints from the interchange to 11th Avenue. So we know from our history that when we try to improve safety conditions, intersections are crucial for safety locations. This map here shows the collision data between 2015 and 2019, with the maps having a scaling circle that show how frequent and how severe those locations are. So we can see that Northwest 11th Avenue is a spot where we need to pay attention, 15th Avenue, as well as on the bottom map there, 29th Avenue. This is no surprise to you. You know where these collisions tend to occur. So as part of the urban holding removal, there were five significant projects that needed to be reasonably funded in order to remove them, remove urban holding. And those projects are 179th Street at 50th Avenue, 179th Street at 29th Avenue. These are intersection improvements. 15th Avenue will be a new segment. New extension will be made from 179th Street to reconnect to 10th Avenue, excuse me. And then underneath the interchange, 179th Street will have to be improved to accommodate the interchange reconstruction. Also, Northeast 10th Avenue is currently being constructed from 149th to 154th. This is the final phase of the Whipple Creek Bridge project. The Northeast 29th Avenue is, we're designing that in collaboration with OTAC. This is scheduled for construction in 2024. Here you're showing, we're showing you a markup of the future roundabout at that location. Here's the future roundabout at 50th Avenue. 50th Avenue intersection may have interim improvements, meaning turn lanes may be added before the roundabout is added, but the long-term intersection improvement at 50th and 179th is a roundabout. You all know this just as much as staff knows it. This is our street classifications. This chart here is showing the major roads, what's the right-of-way requirement, the paved width requirement, the design speed, as well as whether direct access is allowed or not. So this direct access plays a major function in the proposal that we're showing you today. Here you're seeing the local road classifications. These local roads do allow direct access. Driveways can be located off of them. They are more of local roads than they are major roads. So I'll start with the proposal and try to get through this quickly to save your time. There's a lot going on with these maps, though, so I want to first give you a sense of what's going on. What you're seeing is in highlighted are the roads that are proposed as new in the arterial atlas, additions in the arterial atlas. On this map on 179th Street, those additional roads, these are all classified as neighborhood circulators, so they have direct driveway access. But we want to avoid new roads with the wetlands that we're seeing or forecasting. Also identified on these maps are the intersection types. This is new in the arterial atlas. Intersection types have not been identified. We are proposing to identify the intersection types on this proposal. The red circles are future roundabouts, with the blue squares shown as shared access and right in, right out. So for left turns there, they will utilize the roundabouts to make the full turn movements. You're seeing right now a future collector in pink right in the middle of your screen. There is that is in the arterial atlas currently. It is a proposed road. We're not planning on changing that location, but we're not proposing any change with that future road. So that's why that's not shown as an addition, because it's already in the arterial atlas. Moving from the interchange to 29th Avenue, you're seeing several changes here. Union Road and 10th Avenue will be disconnected from the interchange as part of the interchange reconstruction project, and they will be connected both from the south on, I believe it's one, I forget, to 15th Avenue. But also, we want to realign the future Northeast 15th Avenue to align with the design rather than what the arterial atlas is currently showing it at. We've been coordinating with the Killian Pacific team and the Three Creeks folks to find the location on 15th Avenue that will access their site. We're proposing a roundabout at approximately 12th Avenue. This will be a three-legged roundabout with access to the commercial property to the south. 15th Avenue as a roundabout. And then for the first time, you're seeing these orange and black triangles. Those orange and black triangles are noted as interim access now, but when they have access through a local road network, they will be turned to emergency use only. Again, you're seeing the blue right in, right out access locations. And you're seeing a change to the north of the 22nd Avenue proposed roundabout. We want to remove the neighborhood circulator, bring it to the property line so that it avoids impact to that wetland and mitigation for that wetland. There was also, during the stakeholder committee meeting, there was concern about how that interim access would be dealt with. So there is a qualifier in on this, and I'll read that, Eric. This specifically relates to one of your development proposals. The interim and future access of specific developments is determined based on the conditions of approval. The effect of those conditions will be coordinated with the engineering and design of 179th Street improvements, construction and access of alternative circulation routes, the responsible official imposing the conditions, and the property owners. So coordination all around as far as when those interim full access location are converted to emergency only. From 29th Avenue to 50th Avenue, you're seeing roundabouts at 29th. That's what I showed earlier. Approximately 37th Avenue, 45th Avenue, and 50th Avenue. Specifically on this map, you're seeing the peninsulas that occur between the wetlands and the streams there. We're not proposing any new neighborhood circulators cross those wetlands because we recognize the importance of mitigating and preserving those. A future collector is proposed from 179th Street to connect to the collector at 174th Street. This is at approximately 37th Avenue. And then we want to amend the arterial atlas so that it reflects the Woodbrook PUD permitting that was approved, with roundabouts at approximately 45th. And those are connected, again, through neighborhood circulators, so direct access is allowed. And then on the south west quadrant of 50th Avenue and 179th Street, that's mixed-use land. So there is a future commercial industrial road that's proposed at the location at approximately, 48th Avenue. In addition to that, we're also proposing wildlife corridors be a part of this planning effort, as well as pedestrian access ways. Terry, with the North Haven subdivision, we're showing the pedestrian access way that is part of your development, as well as the connection to the trail network. It's hard to see on this screen, but there's a light pink line showing the connection to the amphitheater trails. Here you're seeing the green line shown as wildlife areas. These are basically intended for public works staff. As we design 179th Street, we want to make sure that there's crossings that are safe for wildlife. and more of refuges that they can avoid directly crossing 179th Street. This is a recommendation that came out of our stakeholder group and some of our resident concerns. Again, here's wildlife corridors that you're seeing from 29th Avenue to 50th Avenue. So our approval process, we've started the public outreach process in January. Going to you today, Planning Commission hearing is scheduled for February 17th, and they'll hear both your recommendation as well as Planning Commission recommendation on March 15th. We are recommending approval of the Arterial Atlas Amendments. Those amendments will implement the 179th Street Access Management and Circulation Plan. So with that, I'm open for questions.
Does anybody have any questions for Matt?
Real quick, regarding the wildlife corridor connectivity, are those going to be via like underpasses or overpasses or underpasses?
So if you can see those locations where we're identifying those wildlife corridors occur at streams. So obviously there's some culverts or grade separation that occurs at those locations. It will be visioned as a refuge area for wildlife to go either underneath, I would suppose, the 179th Street. But instead of just a culvert, it would be for their environment, not the building.
It'd be like an overpass.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then the other question I had was, what is the status of the 179th Street I-5 intersection improvements?
Intersection or interchange? I'm sorry.
Interchange. Sorry.
Sorry to be technical. So, the 179th Interchange Reconstruction Project is headed by WSDOT. Clark County is coordinating with them frequently. I do believe that in the Connecting Washington bill, it is tapped as 2025. So I believe that's when the money starts happening and they can really ramp up the design of that. There have been preliminary design that Clark County and WSDOT have coordinated in, but that will be refined in the future.
Right, thanks.
Okay, is there any other questions for Matt?
Yeah, quick question, Matt. This goes back to earlier in the presentation, but is that entire corridor then looked like the design speed is 50 miles an hour. Did you give any considerations, particularly looking at 34th Street or 34th Avenue? You're talking about a 30-foot fill.
Yeah.
For adjusting the design speed locally, it's going to be a pretty urban area, so.
Yeah. So we have considered that. We have considered that stretch of road and those curbs. One thing that we have been evaluating is the ability to illuminate the road, which typically unincorporated Clark County doesn't have lighting on the streets, but illuminating the road can reduce the sight distance or safety issues of the road. So that is something that we're looking at in order to refine the grading that would be necessary for a 50 mile per hour road.
Yeah, I agree. Certainly using a comfort criteria on those sag curves instead of the full sight distance under dark conditions, that'd be a dramatic change in the profile, I think. So,
yeah.
Okay, anybody else for that? So, Matt, I guess just one thing. So are you looking for a formal direction from DEEB on this to go to the PC with at this point?
I would like, and please note that the way your recommendations have happened in the past, it's not a recommendation to the Planning Commission. Your recommendation is both considered directly by Clark County Council. So they go, your recommendation and the Planning Commission's recommendation go concurrently. It's not one recommendation to the other, if that makes sense.
Okay, that makes sense. Seth, I see you're raising your hand.
Yeah, one question I had with regard to the stuff to the west of I-5, there's some of those that appear to be circulator streets, and it's within areas that are not zoned for residential. I think some of those areas there we've run into in the past that we've been forced to do road modification requests for access to those when we have commercial or other accesses proposed. So I guess just a thought to consider there. And then also with those being on the arterial atlas, just I guess as those properties develop, when a circulator street is on an arterial atlas, just understanding, I guess, that there's some level of flexibility that's needed in order to, you know, adjust those based on specific site developments. Just, you know, as it's often when we end up seeing them on the arterial atlas, which typically are more like the collector and arterial streets, not so much the circulators, but they just are a little bit more locked down and it's more difficult to adjust them for the development that takes place.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that comment. So this, where that roundabout is there at approximately 2nd Avenue is the line between commercial and residential zoning. Hold on, let me clarify. Yeah, so what we're trying to do, so this is approximately where that roundabout will is proposed. What we're trying to do is facilitate the commercial on both sides of that future neighborhood circulator and separate it from, sorry to jump around. Yeah. From the residential and mixed use that's located further westward. And you're right, there is flexibility with the neighborhood circulators. We have an ordinance that we speak to quite often as far as the ability to flex that location. The tricky thing is when we put the burden of the future road on one property owner, we have issues with noticing requirements, but there is some flexibility that's built in there.
Okay. And just to make it clear, as far as the neighborhood circulators, the county code says that the commercial is prohibited from accessing that unless there's an alternative access of a different classification. So just to make sure that's clear.
Okay, thank you. That's a good point.
Hey, Mike, before I call you, I want to do a time check real quick. Is everybody cool with hanging around for like 5 more minutes? Okay, go ahead, Mike.
Thank you. Matt, I represent some of the property owners where some of these proposed neighborhood circulators are running through, as well as the roundabouts. And they've already had pre-apps as far as site development on them. And we know that there are critical areas, streams, wetlands and stuff. And I'm speaking specifically at 2nd Avenue and that they are going to be moving forward with development. In fact, we have approval of a temporary use for them and we'll be moving forward with a full master plan that does not include a roadway to the north. What kind of notification have you given the property owners that they had that this is proposed? And the reason why I ask is that in the past, I've heard that the county is not required to provide notification to any property owners where there might be a proposed arterial going through their property. I'm speaking of the Barberton area on a past project that we did about 15 years ago. And this is when I send this to them, they are going to come unglued and probably start making phone calls and hiring attorneys and such. So what can you say as far as the flexibility regarding these accesses and these proposed corridors?
So we have notified all property owners within 300 feet of proposed arterial atlas amendments. So those property owners that abut these future planned roads have been notified. They've received both invitations to a public open house that was held on January 27th, as well as the public hearing with the Planning Commission scheduled on February 17th. They will also be notified when the County Council makes their ultimate decision in the future. We have talked to several current residents. Their concerns were these roads and what the county is going to build on these roads. And we mentioned that these are lines on the map right now. They are only developed as development occurs. So they have been notified. This is, I'm unaware of pre-ups that have happened regarding these properties that you speak of, but we should consider them now. If you could forward me those information, it's best to address it now.
Yeah, okay. We'll take that up offline. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I'm going to be mindful of time. We're at 4:30, so entertain a motion here if there is a motion to support the changes.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we support what Matt's put forth. I think it's a great deal of work and it's pretty well thought out.
Okay, it's been moved by Mr. Weisner. Is there a second? Okay, moved and seconded by Eric. Second. Any discussion? All those deed members signify by saying aye and raising your hand. Aye.
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 All those opposed?
I will abstain.
Okay, and Mr. Odrin abstains. Okay, there you go, Matt. I guess you've got that.
Thank you.
Okay. Appreciate it. The last item on the agenda is public comment. We're obligated to hear. Is there any member of the public wishing to testify at this point? Justin.
So I will make this really quick. The BIA has submitted two letters of comment, both for the Clark County housing options as well as the Vancouver housing code update. Those should be on the record. If they are not, you can email me. You can find my email at the BIA of ClarkCounty.org. Or it's also on the deed distribution list.
Okay. Thank you, Justin. The one final thing, just a housekeeping matter. I did forget to mention this at the start of the meeting, but Mr. Russo and Mr. Riston had contacted me prior to the meeting, letting me know that they had absences, and I did sort of excuse them based on where they're at. The next meeting will be March 3rd coming up. I don't think we have a set agenda yet for this, so I just wanted to briefly touch base back with the deed members to revisit that. And, I mean, do we want to, A, revisit some of the housing discussion that came up today in light of the ad hoc committee that will also form? Might be one item. And, Brent, I don't know if staff has anything else that they're needing to raise next month as well. But maybe this is something Deeb can take offline as well.
Yeah, I don't have anything from staff at this time, but I'll definitely reach out and try to see if there's anything in the next week and we can coordinate.
Okay. So I guess look forward to some emails here in the next couple weeks. And with that, I really appreciate everybody staying over 4 minutes and have a great February.
Cheers.
Thanks, Dan.
See you guys.